Hi everyone, we are on season 8, episode 13, and today it's just me, and I'm going to be taking you through some of the key points of shareholder protection insurance. This is the Practical Protection Podcast. So this is going to be not a particularly long podcast episode. I say that, but we all know that I do talk quite extensively. So I'll try and do my best to keep it as short as possible. So we're just going to be doing a little bit of an overview of shareholder protection. Really some of the key points that you need to be aware of as an advisor, places that things can go wrong. And you know, it's the kind of thing where with shareholder protection, what I always find really, really useful, and I'm sure that many of you would find this useful as well, is if I was going to be doing a new kind of insurance policy, or if I'd not done shareholder protection for a while, anything like that, then I would literally ink to Google my shareholder protection and then an insurer's name. Just pick an insurer that you like in a sense, or that you want to choose, one that pops into your mind. And what you do tend to find on the insurer's websites is that they do have really, really good pages that take you through examples of how shareholder protection works. They'll be written by the specialists from the insurer who do this day in, day out. So, you know, they really, really know their stuff. So strongly suggest that you do that. On the Cure Insurance website, there is also some shareholder protection pages. There's obviously this that you can refer to as well. And, you know, just re-familiarize yourself if you've not done it for a while, because things can obviously change. And if, as I say, if you don't do this day in, day out, it can, you know, it's not always at the front of your mind. And there are certain things that we really, really do need to know, especially in terms of the taxation issues that we can potentially see in terms of business protection. So it's one of those things that not really to dabble in and just kind of dabble in a whim, you know, in a sense, dabbling's fine. But as long as if you are dabbling, if you just thought I'd do, it's not really your comfort zone, not something you've done much of, not something you've done in a while, then do reach out to those specialists. I have to say for myself as well, I've always found with insurers that they do have, as I say, those brilliant business protection specialists that sit within the company. And they are incredibly helpful if you do reach out to them and just say to them, well, can you just take me through this? Can you take me through that? So helpful. Sometimes obviously they'll be able to put in together training for you specifically for your team and getting you like the really in-depth, you know, senior kind of business people who know the taxations, know the laws and the different things that are going around with them. So let's get into the shareholder protection side of things. So basically, shareholder protection, what we're doing is we're protecting the shareholder's family, we're protecting the shareholder themselves, and we're protecting the company. And what could be quite interesting, I think, and some people don't necessarily think about with shareholder protection, and quite a few of the different business protection policies that are there, is that we are speaking to the individual often. You know, we are speaking to the shareholder, and the shareholder is obviously our client, but the business is our client. And I think that is something that kind of gets missed at times. You know, ultimately, the shareholder is very likely the business owner, or the business owners usually. And yes, they are the ones that we're speaking to, but the entity, the company itself, is the client. So when we're doing our recommendation reports, when we're looking at things, there shouldn't really be, in a sense, too much personal kind of circumstances brought into it and things like that, because ultimately, and I say personal, so I'm talking mortgages, things like that, because ultimately this is to do with the business needs. And what we're wanting to do, and we can do shareholder protection for a number of different things like life insurance, critical illness cover. But for the purpose of this podcast, I'm just going to refer to life insurance because it's just less words for me to say and it'll just be nicer for me. So forgive me for that. But just remember, we can on some of these interchange it with critical illness cover. So what we're trying to do is make sure that, say, like if the shareholder dies, that their family receives a fair value for the shares that they held. And obviously, if they were to become critically ill, that they themselves receive a fair value for the shares. And at the same time as that, we're making sure that the business retains those shares and is able to keep the shares, or I say retain it, depending upon how technical you want to be with me, that can maybe not be the case, depending upon the type of shareholder protection that we're doing. But basically, we're wanting the company to keep the shares. And the really sort of like simple, I would hope, easy way to think about this is, let's say we've got three shareholders and they've all got equal shareholding. Which means that, you know, if you have a third of a business each, that basically on that level, you do have what's known as a like a vetoing power. You do have absolute authority to make decisions in the company. So if the company wants to go in direction, you need all the shareholders involved. If one of them says no, then that can stop the plans because of the amount of shareholding that somebody has. So let's say of these three shareholders, one of them has passed away. And we don't have a shareholder agreement in place in terms of the insurances and certain cross-option agreements that we'll go over. And what we will find, though, is that the next of kin would then receive shares because obviously they're going to inherit it. Now, the problem is that the shareholder's passed away. His next of kin is their 19-year-old kid who's just got out of college, absolutely no business knowledge. Doesn't know anything about the industry that the company's in, doesn't know anything about the relationships, but, you know, they're quite, you know, happy to come in and think, well, hey, I've got this business now. This is obviously, they're obviously going to be upset about obviously losing a parent usually. But, you know, they're going to be thinking, brilliant. But the problem is that they don't understand anything and they're wanting to do something super radical because they're young and think that the business needs to take a new direction, which might be a brilliant decision, but it might not be as well. And what we don't want is for the current, you know, the existing shareholders with all this knowledge, all these business relationships that they have, all these plans going forward, these forecasts, the strategies, they go ahead to do them. And this kid comes along and goes, no, not doing that. And then they can't do anything. So that's why this is really important that we're saying that protecting the business as well as protecting those existing shareholders. There are a few types of shareholder protection that we can do. We do have cross-option agreement and company buyback that we're going to be focusing on today. There is another one, but it does have potential inheritance tax issues. So we don't tend to really go into that area. I've, in my time of advising, have not needed to use that approach. I would have used this cross-option or company buyback, depending upon the client's situation. And so we're going to go through them because they are the more usual ones that we'll be doing. There's probably more for me to go through in some ways with the cross option, if I take that from the start, just on the basis that I'm going to just be explaining the whole shareholder thing. So it's going to seem like company buyback has a lot less for me to talk through, but it's because I've already, probably discussed a lot of the fundamentals that we'll need to be discussing. So let's have a look at cross option shareholder agreement. Now, when you're doing this, you would ideally want to see the articles of association that a company holds. That's kind of like their business rules manuals that they have kind of set up with the company because you want to make sure there's no conflict. Now, a lot of the time, you know, about 80% of businesses in the UK are SMEs. So they are small businesses. A lot of them are family run. And so probably the owners, the shareholders are going to have a very, very good idea about what those articles of association say. It might be that when you're recommending as well in this, that you end up speaking with accountants. You might end up speaking with solicitors. You might even end up speaking to some taxation advisors as well for the that represent the company or the individuals in the company. So try not to be put off by that. I say this from experience in the sense of I was giving somebody some shareholder protection guidance and there was somebody that was advising, had a tax advisor who was saying that I was doing everything wrong. And I got myself so paranoid because I kind of thought, oh my word, there's a tax advisor here saying I'm doing everything wrong. I must be doing everything wrong. I must have, you know, like just not understood any of this, you know, even though I knew it all. And obviously I spoke with the insurers and I went to those specialists that I just mentioned before, those really key business specialists in the insurers. And they were absolutely amazing. And they were just sort of like, no, you're doing it all right. The tax advisor's wrong. And I think probably, especially if you're newish to advising, it can be a real, you know, you can feel really paranoid at times as to whether or not you are doing things right or not. I mean, obviously, it's each person to their own personality. But I'm somebody who can suddenly feel very like, oh, I've done it wrong. You know, if somebody questions me and sort of like, and they're from like what I consider like a position of real, maybe authority in a certain area. You know, this was a tax advisor, you know, obviously, and you know, also as well, you get like maybe an accountant and you thought like, oh, wow, well, the accountant must know much. But ultimately, when you are learning about these things, when you're advising, do stick to your guns. You know, what I did in that situation is I held my own when I was speaking and saying, no, I'm pretty sure I'm right, but I will go and double check. That's the best thing to do is always say, look, I'm pretty sure I'm right, but I will double check. I went and checked with the business specialist. I got everything written down that needed to be written down to explain that I was in fact right. And I went back And ultimately, I have to say, the tax advisor learned something new. So do stick to your guns if you need to, but always be prepared to be humble and check as well. So with a cross-option agreement, this is a certain way of doing shareholder protection. And with some companies, it's not going to be the most favourite option. And I will get to that as we get there. But with cross-option agreements, what it can be is it can be an own life policy that's written to trust of the other shareholders, or it can be a life of another business policy, life insurance policy, written obviously for the other shareholders to be benefiting from it. Now, when we do life of another, that can be okay, but it can get messy if there's more than a few shareholders. So a lot of the time, it can just be simpler to do own life into trust for the other shareholders, because then what we do is we have one policy, then we have the trust, which then lists the other shareholders, which is really quite nice and simple and straightforward. If we do it as life of another, then the difficulty we have is that each shareholder then needs to take out a policy on each of the other shareholders. So we can start getting huge amounts of policies being written. It can get very, very complicated. There are different ways that different people want to do it, depending upon situations. But usually, you know, I would say if you've got more than three shareholders, then it's probably nicer for everyone involved if we just do own life policy into trust. And what's going to happen with this is the accountant's going to value the company, and then you're going to look to arrange a life insurance policy to match the value of the shares. You can find that once you reach a certain amount of share value across the company, that some insurers will want to see financial accounts to prove the share values. As I say, 80% of SMEs are, 80% of businesses in the UK are SMEs. Not all of them have share values that are going to start going into that kind of a level. You know, we can go quite high before we need to start really going into the financial account side of things. I did a shareholder protection once, so it was quite a few people, 5-6 people in the company. They were only to do share protection for. And the majority of insurers were just like, yeah, we'll insure this person for this value, for this value, for this value, because we weren't reaching financial underwriting limits per person when we broke it down, the value of those shares per person. But then one insurer had said, well, actually, because across the market, this is going to be more than 3 million, we actually want financial underwriting on the policies you're putting with us. So do keep an eye on that. It is, of course, nicer if you can keep all the policies with one insurer. But as we all know, many of us who are listening to this, there are many things that can change which insurers best. We've got health, we've got travel, we've got sport. And whilst, you know, we could potentially keep it all with one company, and we can say that to the client, you know, I can keep it all here, but this means that actually there's a slightly cheaper option for this person over there. But let's keep it all together to keep it simple. Some firms might want to do that, but you do really, especially from like a consumer duty point of view, you do really want to let them know about that cheaper option, because ultimately it doesn't actually make that big a difference. Because with the shareholder protection, the cross-option agreement, we will be putting a cross-option agreement in place, which is just a document that would sit with the articles of association. And it basically says, if something happens to this person, these people are going to receive, you know, the shares. In a sense, which is obviously lovely and exactly what we want it to do. Now, when I did it, and obviously we always have to check with each individual case, but I had it where I had this firm, as I say, with quite a few people, and three different insurers were better for these people depending upon their risks. And I said to the insurers, I was like, well, what do I do in terms of a cross-option agreement? Can I even do this across three of you? And they're like, absolutely, you can do, but what you just need to be aware of is that you need to choose a cross-option agreement and use that for all of us, in a sense. So I was just like, oh, thank you. And I got this confirmation from each of the insurers. And so I just picked the nicest one. They basically said, just pick the nicest one out of the three insurers. So I went from the nicest one, the simplest one, very, very simple, nice and easy for the clients to understand. And we got it all done and dusted. But the reason that cross-option agreement isn't always the favoured option is that the premiums can be offset against corporation tax, but they are classed as a P11D benefit. So that does mean that the shareholders are paying for those policies personally, which as a business owner, they're going to prefer the option where they don't have to pay for it personally. And depending upon the size of the premium, as I say, you might get accountants coming in, tax advisors coming in saying, hang on a minute, We don't want this person paying as much money and things like that. But there's a really interesting thing with cross-option agreements that we need to be aware of. And that is something known as premium equalization. And this must be done on a cross-option agreement for shareholder protection, because if it isn't, HMRC could see the payout as a gift. So we really, really want to be careful about this. With premium equalization, what happens is each shareholder pays for or towards the other shareholders' premiums. And if we're doing it on an own life policy in trust. So I'll take an example, hopefully to make it easy, as easy as possible. So we've got two people, let's say two shareholders, Mr. A and Mrs. B. So Mr. A is going to pay the premiums for Mrs. B's policy, because Mr. A would be benefiting from it if Mrs. B does pass away. So, which is obviously exactly what we would want it to be doing, and vice versa. So then when you have three people, you'll find that if, let's say, Mr. A, Mrs. B, and let's say Dr. C. So something happens, let's just say we won't get to claim here. So we're going to go set these policies up. So what happens is Mr. A and Mrs. B equally pay towards Dr. C's protection insurance, because again, they're both going to equally going to benefit from that policy. I say equally, I'm assuming here that everyone's got the same amount of shareholding. Obviously, people with different shareholding would come into it, but this might sound like quite intense. The accountants will be doing this. You're not the one that's responsible for doing those calculations with premium equalization. Some insurers are able to help and give you the calculations, so you can say to the people, right, this is what needs to happen. You need to pay this for this one, and you need to pay for this for this one. But ultimately, it's the accountants that are responsible for sorting that. But it's your responsibility as the advisor to make sure that the person is aware and that their accountant is aware that the premium equalisation needs to be done. So when you're doing your demands and needs report, your recommendation letter, just make sure we've got a statement in there saying that this premium equalisation must be done, has to be done. The accountant needs to do it, or else there is potential, as I say, that it could be seen as a gift, which we certainly want to avoid if at all possible. So let's have a look at company buyback now. So this is the one where it's a bit faffy, I have to say. Maybe people in the business side of things wouldn't see it as faffy, but for me, it feels a bit faffy. And but it can certainly work. And, you know, you can certainly get to a point where people are really insistent they want to do this, because the premiums are paid for by the company, which is, as a company owner, they're probably going to want that, which is obviously, you know, something that I'm a company owner myself. I would much rather the company pay for something than me pay for it myself. But there are some potential drawbacks that we should be really, really mindful of when we're speaking to people about this. So we set it up as a life of another policy, and it's paid for by the company, which is very, very tempting, as I say, to the shareholders, because we're not paying for the premiums ourselves. But it doesn't get corporation tax relief, so just be mindful of that too. You need to have been a shareholder for 3 years to really be able to access company buyback. You can do it without the 3 year, but there is some potential for issues with taxation. So again, just be really mindful of that. You know, we would usually say to try and avoid as much as possible, like any errant kind of taxations that we don't want to see, that we ideally want them to have 3 years of being a shareholder for that company to be able to do this. So the company's very excited. You've given them an option. They don't need to pay the premiums for themselves. But let's say one of the shareholders dies. We'll do Mr. A and Mrs. B again. I'm just going to keep to two people because it's easier for me. So let's say that Mr. A dies. Now, what that means with the company buyback arrangement, Mrs. B needs to make a statement to the registrar of companies that Mr. A has died. And this also has to be a statement in something known as the Gazette. I don't know what the Gazette is. I keep imagining like some kind of film noir office with somebody with a Gazette, with a cigar. And, you know, there's just like these newspapers getting reeled off and all this kind of stuff. I'm sure it's not like that anymore. Maybe it was never like that anyway. But anyway, so this Gazette thing, okay? And what that is a Gazette is something where business people and creditors especially watch the Gazette to see if there's been any changes in the companies that they've invested in. Quite naturally, why wouldn't you? And the problem can be is that with this, so let's say we've got Mr. A and Mrs. B, And let's say that, I say, Mr. A has died and he's got a best mate. And they went to school together and, they've basically, I don't know, grown up together, super, super close. This best mate absolutely trusts Mr. A with his money. And he's given him, let's say, £100,000 to go into the company. And he sees in the Gazette that his friend's died. I mean, obviously you would assume that he would know that anyway, but let's just say for this sake that he's not noticed it in the Gazette. Well, he's a creditor to this company. And he doesn't know Mrs. B at all. And he doesn't think the company's going to survive without Mr. A. He might well come to the company and say, I want my money back. And that's potentially obviously an issue because does the company have £100,000 spare to pay this guy? Because they're also going to have to make sure as well, they're going to be getting money in from the shareholder, obviously, claim, but that's meant to be going to the family. So what happens at point of claim? Obviously, the company receives the payout, and then what they do is they buy the shares from the family and they cancel those shares. So when I said earlier about retaining, this is where I sort of like thought, oh, somebody in specialist business mode and jargon and everything could really pick me up here. So this isn't necessarily about retaining the shares. This is retaining the control in a sense of the company within the shareholders because we're paying the family and we're just cancelling those shares down. So, in a sense of again, the Mr. A, Mrs. B, we've paid Mr. A's family and the value of the shares, Mrs. B shares, then automatically are worth 100% of the company value. She's not brought those shares back in. She's not bought them back in, but she's just got 50% shareholding, but they're literally the only shares left in the company. So they are 100%. So we really, really want to be on top of that. The other thing to be very mindful of as well in terms of shareholdings and things like that, it would be unusual, but with this kind of arrangement where we do have to cancel down the shares and then the existing shareholders' share values changes, you can sometimes have it where people, they don't necessarily want certain people, certain shareholders maybe don't want to have, like, as I said before, that magical kind of like 30% in terms of shareholding where you get controlling function in a company. That's the right word, controlling function. I've been trying to think of that all along. There we go. I've got it now. Maybe not everybody wants to have a 30% share or more. Maybe some people don't want certain people in the company to have more than 30%. Maybe it's deliberately meant to be lower. So we need to be very, very mindful of this when we are doing it, because just make sure that everybody's aware of how it would work. It wouldn't just be against, say, buying in the shares. With this one, it is we are cancelling them down and everyone's shares just automatically change and kind of grow if somebody does die. And we need to be very, very conscious as well with this. As I say, it's going to be going somewhere where the creditors could be seeing it and they could come in and suddenly say, we want that money back. Now, the company might have surplus cash to be able to pay that back as well. But the last thing we want to do is have the, in a sense, the shareholders suddenly the money comes in and we may be having to pay that to a creditor rather than getting those shares back or paying the family for the shares, because we really, really want to make sure that we're getting those shares back again for the reason of you just never know in terms of next of kin and their power and their influence on the company, what they're going to want to doing. And also a lot of families probably wouldn't want to do that. So something I didn't mention as well, which I need to go back to quickly for the cross option agreement, is with the cross option agreement, either party can enact it. So, as I say, goes back to Mr. A and Mrs. B. Mr. A dies. Well, let's say Mrs. B wants to buy the shares, but the family don't want to. With the cross option agreement, Mrs. B can enact the cross option agreement arrangement, and the family has to sell the shares to her. She has to. She's saying, "I am buying them. You must sell to me," and that has to happen. With the other way, Mr. A's died, and Mrs. B's thinking, I don't want to buy these shares because the money, kind of thing. But the family can enact the shareholder agreement, the cross option agreement, and say, well, we don't care what's going on with the business. You're paying us the value of these shares. So either party can enact it, neither can say no about it. So just be mindful of all of those things. So cross option agreement, key things, premium equalization, either party can enact it. Premiums are offset against corporation tax, but they are with P11D. Company buyback, it's obviously the company pays for it, no corporation tax relief. We do have to make those extra statements if somebody does die into the places where the creditors are potentially going to be seeing them. the shares are cancelled down rather than being in a sense bought back. And ideally, we want the shareholder to have been there for 3 years just because we don't want to risk any kind of taxation issues if they've been there for less than that. So to give you an example of how kind of the premium equalization works, I'm going to give you an example of a shareholder protection policy that was done with six people. And obviously with that one, we did do it on an own life policy because we weren't going to do life of another because it was just going to get to a silly, silly amount of policies. And we did it with the cross option agreement rather than the company buyback because of that issue in terms of, sorry, the creditors and what they could potentially demand and things like that. So as an example, so we had one member that was insured for £600,000 of life insurance. And it was 5 yearly renewable. Shareholder protection is usually 5 yearly or 10 yearly renewable. Just because shareholders can change, it just means that it's just the way it's meant to work, basically. And for this person, the cost of their policy was £24 per month. Now, through premium equalisation, that meant that the other five shareholders each paid £4.80 towards that person's insurance. So another thing you can find is that somebody might see their premiums on the premium equalisation, and maybe they're older than the others. Maybe they've had some health conditions. Maybe they're doing some kind of risky sports, anything like that. Their premiums are phenomenally higher than the rest. And they can think, well, I don't want to pay for this out of my own money. And I don't know all this stuff. It's just really important to remember to just go back and go, but you're not paying for it. Actually, the others are going to be paying for your policy. And they've all got policies that are really, really cheap. So you're paying towards this. So you're not actually going to be paying that much because you're just paying for the really low cost people in a sense. And they're obviously all contributing towards yours because they'd be the ones that would benefit from it. So if people are feeling a little bit like, oh, that price, I'm not sure about that premium, just to say, remember this, it does have to be equalized. So it isn't usually as intense as a lot of people think. So that is a very, very quick rundown. Thank you for listening, everybody. Next time, Matt Ryan is going to be back with me and we'll be talking about protection insurance and antiphospholipid syndrome. If you'd like to visit our website, practical-protection.co.uk, you can access all our episodes there, and you can also get a CPD certificate thanks to our sponsors, the Octa members. Thank you very much for listening, and I will speak to you all soon. Bye.